Well, good evening to everybody. I appreciate the prayer, Jim, very much. The older I get, sound like Mr. Experience here, but the older I get, the more I realize I need that. We have been looking at the archaeological footprint left by the children of Israel's sojourn in the land of Egypt. We will be, Lord willing, next week getting into the actual exit from Egypt and maybe even into the conquest, but that's our planned framework. Last week, we took a look at briefly at this pharaoh. His name is Amenemhat III. His reign began in 1678, and based on a new chronology that is being espoused by agnostic Egyptologist David Roll, he would have been the pharaoh when Joseph arrived in Egypt. This man seems perfectly fit to be that pharaoh because during his reign, Egypt suffered a terrible and prolonged famine that we saw last week was caused not by drought, but by what? Flooding. Extreme flooding. For several years, the Bible tells us just how long, seven, the records at this spot down south in the southern part of Egypt, we see at the top and the bottom, these are either side of a narrow passage in the Nile. These two forts were used to watch the flooding. And of course, the Egyptians taxed their people based on how high the floodwaters were. And for a period of 7 years, the Bible tells us, but it matches up with the general evidence we have, the floodwaters got about 15 feet higher than normal, which meant good flooding, very fertile fields. But then in year 20 of Amenemhat's reign, disaster struck and floodwaters went four times higher than normal. David Roll describes it this way: the Nile floodwaters swept over the valley like a tsunami, bursting levees, drowning livestock, washing away the mud brick villages built on low-lying sandy mounds along the valley floor. Temples were flooded, the whole land came to a grinding halt as people struggled with the consequences of the abnormally gigantic flood. This is what it looks like when the Nile floods Egypt. And when these floodwaters came in so high and so much, what were the people not able to do? They were not able to plant. And that's exactly what Joseph told his brothers. Genesis 45:6, for these 2 years the famine has been in the land, and there are still 5 years in which there will be neither plowing nor harvesting. The floods flooded the land to such an extent that they couldn't even plow, and certainly not harvest. Now, during the years of the good flood, Egypt had to respond to what they knew was coming. The Bible tells us that they knew it was coming. So what did they do? Well, Amenemhat III began an administration called, or a department called, the Department of the People's Giving. Now, we're not told much about what this department did, but it certainly seems to line up with what was going on during the 7 years of plenty. Because what did Joseph tell the Pharaoh we will need to do to get ready for the years of famine? Yeah, we're going to need to gather up one-fifth of the produce of the land. So it looks like this may have been the department responsible for doing that. And also, knowing that these extreme floods were coming, look what David Roll says. As if guided by some remarkable premonition, a massive project was begun to construct this canal. The canal began south at the southern part of the Nile River, and it redirected water all the way to this place called the Fayum Basin, and when full, created this lake called Lake Meris. Herodotus saw this, and what has this canal for thousands of years been called? The waterway of Joseph. This seems to be part of what the Egyptians did to prepare for the coming floods and probably helped them mitigate the floods for more than the 7 years. This is what it looks like today. I showed you last week. Here's another picture. Some parts are prettier than others, but it's still there today. Furthermore, during the years of famine produced by this extreme flooding, there's this huge switch of power and wealth. these regions throughout Egypt that each had their own governor. The governors were very wealthy. They built these beautiful shrines to themselves when they died. But Egyptologists look at history and they say there's this time period where all the wealth leaves these regional governors and gets bound up with the Pharaoh. And what would account for that? The secular historians don't know. What does the Bible tell us would account for that? Yes. Genesis 47 tells us during the years of famine, they brought money into Pharaoh's house. Joseph did. He bought their livestock. He bought the people and their land. There was nothing else for the governors to gain wealth from. All of it went to the Pharaoh, just like the Bible says. As we draw the review to a close, we met a man last week. Well, it may not be the first time we met him, but we met him by a name. Joseph was given a name by Pharaoh. Can anyone remember what it was? All right, Zaphnath what? I'm hearing it. Paniah. Now pause the Egyptian word for the. Does anyone remember what Anea means? Life. And this is the pronunciation that comes to us, but more the appropriate ancient vocalization and there, I don't even completely understand it, and I'm not going to bore you with it. But it actually would have been pronounced this way by the people of the time. Ankh, which we've heard of the Ankh. And there is a vizier right at this time when all this flooding is going on. He is the most renowned figure of the time. And his name is Ankhu. Could this be Joseph by the Egyptian name? Well, it certainly sounds like it could be. The Department of the People's Giving was established during his viziership. We read about the granaries of Ankhu, where all that grain may have been getting gathered. He had two sons. We get their Egyptian names. The Bible may be giving us their Hebrew names. And what do the Egyptians call him in the Egyptian texts? He is Ankhu, who is called Pa'am, that is the Asiatic. He's not an Egyptian. Whoever this man was, he was not an Egyptian. And it sounds an awful lot like Joseph. Now, I kept telling you last week we hadn't gotten to my favorite part. We're ready for my favorite part. There is a city in the eastern part of the Egyptian Delta along the Pelusiac branch. You've got all those branches. I can hit the right button first. All these different branches of the Nile once it comes up into the Delta. This, I believe, is the Pelusiac branch. And right along it is this settlement that the Egyptians knew as Avaris. It is in the land of Goshen. And all those little white dots are a bunch of other sites that are like it, but we haven't gotten to them yet. And starting in the 1960s, the Austrians began to excavate this site at Avaris. One of the things they found in this site is there is a house. It was torn down, but they are able to determine that it was of Syrian design. Manfred Bietak is the Austrian Egyptologist. He's in his 60s. He's been doing this for 30-some years down there. It's been his life, or a huge part of it. And there's this Syrian house. It's built after Syrian design. It's got this courtyard in it. It's not built like an Egyptian would build their house. Manfred Bietak said of this house, this foreign design suggested to him that its owner was from Syria. Now, where is Syria? Just north of Israel. And do we know anybody who came from Syria? Or came through there at least? Abraham came through there. That's where his brother stayed. That's where Jacob went back to get his wife. That's where Isaac's wife came from. I don't know if this house belongs to any of those people or not. But built on top of this house, the Syrian house was torn down and built on top of it in Avaris, was a palace, a small palace. This is a reconstruction of it. It's much more Egyptian in character than the house it was built over. It's built for a person of high status, had all the trappings of wealth and power, courtyards, colonnade, audience chambers, even a robing room. And it was built in two parts. Actually, this is where the new part was added on. This is the new part. This first part was fronted by a portico of 12 wooden columns. Now, this is not me or somebody else trying to create information. This is what's been found. Now, there's admittedly a little bit of interpretation involved, but this is what's been found. A palace, mini semi-palace, fronted with 12 wooden columns. At a later date, the palace was added on to. This is those 12 columns. And then this part was added on to it. Kind of a shared area. And then look here. Two suites of rooms were added on to this palace. In the garden behind the palace were 12 main tombs, each with a memorial chapel on top of it. So they would create a tomb, the body would be buried, and then on top there'd be this place, you know, where you could visit, remember the person, so on and so forth. Here's another reconstruction of these 12 tombs. Is this starting to sound like anything? One of the tombs was different from all the others. In fact, completely unique in all of the history of Egypt. Here it is being excavated, and I'll try to do a little interpreting for you. It had two parts. This man is standing in the burial chamber, and then it had a part here in front, this memorial chapel where you could walk into. Here you're seeing it from the other side. Then here is the burial chamber. He's standing in the burial chamber here. And here again is the memorial chapel. And you'll notice these stones here. These are the remains of a statue, which we're going to talk about here in just a moment. Now, first of all, the base is made of mud bricks. When the children of Israel built things in Egypt, what did they build them out of? Mud bricks. Egypt is covered with ancient ruins that are made of mud bricks, mud and straw, just exactly like the Bible says. You know, even the people who do not believe in the inspiration of Exodus will admit that whoever wrote Exodus knew what life in ancient Egypt was like. There are a number of these perfect parallels. They knew what they were talking about. Manfred Bietak, the Austrian archaeologist excavating this site, determined that this square base of mud brick once supported, and he knows his stuff better than I do, it once supported a small mud brick pyramid. Now, that this is a pyramid is huge. At this time in Egyptian history, nobody gets a pyramid except pharaohs and their wives. They are the only ones. No official, no commoner was ever granted a pyramid for a tomb. Whoever this was very important and had connections with the crown. Well, they got into the burial chamber, and when they get into Egyptian burial chambers of kings and pharaohs and so forth, what do they often find, if not almost always? They find a mummy. They don't find the gold and all that. Why not? Well, robbers carried that off. They got lucky with King Tut, and I think maybe it's happened another time or so. Hopefully it'll happen again. But they don't find the valuables, but they do find the mummy, because the mummy's not worth anything. They got inside this burial chamber. They found no coffin, no bones, no pottery, nothing. What they did discover was a robber's tunnel. I believe that may be what you're seeing here. Someone, once upon a time, had gone into the memorial chapel. Pardon me. This part right here had busted through the floor, gone underneath and gone into the burial chamber. And whatever may have been in it, the goods or so forth, they took. But for some reason, they chose to take the body too, which robbers don't do. Genesis 50:25 tells us why. Joseph took an oath from the children of Israel saying, God will surely visit you and you shall carry up my bones from here. And then to top it all off, they discovered a statue. Statue, now this is just part of it. This looks really odd, I know. The face had been broken off. There's where the face started, right here. Here's the hair, shoulders, of course. They get part of the back. They found a foot. He said part of the torso, the head, part of the head, part of the seat, and one foot. Here is what one man said about it. The lower half of the statue had disappeared almost completely, with a foot and part of the seat found scattered in the cemetery. This most likely because the statue took the form of a seated figure and the lower part would have been a convenient rectangular block which could have been reused in another building. Let's stop there for a minute. Do we follow what that's talking about? In the ancient world, you've got things of stone, and if you don't have to make your own stone or go out and dig up stone, you don't. So if you've got an ancient building that's not being used anymore or you don't want it around anymore, you take the blocks from that. When we were in Israel, or pardon me, in Rome in 1995, you go to the Colosseum today, it once had these beautiful marble seats. Well, they're all gone. They've all been taken and they were used for something else. Archaeologists call that secondary use. So this man thinks that this rectangular part of the statue had been taken probably for that reason. He says, one day it may yet turn up and reveal the name and titles of the statue owner, which were usually written in a column of hieroglyphs running down the center of the statue from chest to feet. This style of statue, though usually in miniature or small size, was often used to represent the Egyptian vizier wearing his long gown down to the ankles. Notice what he said, usually in miniature or small size. Not only is it incredible that this man is given a pyramid for a tomb, but he has a statue that is twice human size. A statue is not abnormal, but a statue this big was. Let's look at this statue again. Now, this hairstyle is the envy of every man here. Yeah. This is called the mushroom hairstyle. Really, that's what they call it. And you and I look at that and we go, okay. But that's how an Egyptian artist depicted Asiatics. People who are not from Egypt, people who live north and east, up in Canaan, Syria, Palestine. And you can't see the skin color here, but they are able to see it when they look closely at it. And the skin is not brown and red like Egyptian skin normally is. Rather, it is yellow. His hair, which we can't see the paint here, but they can, is red. When we see Egyptian artwork, what color is Egyptian hair normally? We're always black. So this man has an Asiatic hairdo, Asiatic hair color, Asiatic skin color. Here's an example of that, by the way. Here's some Egyptian art. Here are the Egyptians with the dark hair, the brown, reddish skin, the white tunics. But here are some folks from Asia. Notice they've got multicolored coats, darker hair in this case, more yellowish skin. Those are Asiatics. Notice this thing here. Whenever we see the pharaohs buried, of course, they've got their hands like this, right? And they're carrying something. Well, this man's not holding the same thing that pharaohs hold. That's called a throw stick. It's like a boomerang. The Aborigines would use a boomerang, or whoever, the people in Australia would use it to kill birds. These throw sticks were used by people in Asia to kill birds. The Egyptians would normally depict Asiatics with their throw sticks, but the Asiatics would be subjugated. This man has power and authority, and his throw stick is there as a symbol of his power. All these things indicate that this man would have been a Syro-Palestinian, says Charles Ayling, Egyptologist. One more thing, just as an aside, if you know hieroglyphics, which I don't, but I've read about them, in hieroglyphics, they have what are called determinatives. And the determinative for an Asiatic, in other words, the symbol which indicates the people I'm talking about are Asiatics, is the symbol for a throw stick. So this is very tightly connected. This is not open to a great deal of interpretation. This man was not an Egyptian. He was an Asiatic. Now here's the back of his statue. You see the little throw stick there is the back of his hair. And if you look real carefully, you can see some stripes here. This man is wearing a coat of multiple colors. Here is what it might have looked like when you walked in. Here is what it might have looked like when you looked at it. There is nothing else like this in all of Egyptian history when a Semite is honored in this way. It sounds like we have found Joseph's tomb. It's pretty incredible, I think. Now, this is in Avaris. Joseph is living in a city right there in Goshen. Well, yeah, he's buried in a city and living there in the city in Goshen. So if we've got the right city, if this is one of the places where the children of Israel were in fact living, we ought to find some evidence of more than just Joseph. And we do. At the same time that that waterway, that canal was being built, up here in Avaris, things were just getting started. Had just gotten or were just getting started. This city was being settled, and it was not being settled by Egyptians. It was being settled by people from Syria, Palestine, that area. And we know it because, number one, the graves. Notice how this person is buried. Buried on his left side, knees tucked up in a semi-fetal position. Anybody want to take a guess what these are? What do you think the tomb's made of? Mud bricks. Mud bricks. This is the way a typical Semite culture would bury their dead. The grave goods, the pottery, the weapons are not Egyptian. They are Semitic. These are not Egyptian weapons. These are Semitic, Asiatic weapons. Professor Hoffmeyer says this: we do know that there was a large Semitic-speaking population which probably came from Syria, Canaan. We have tombs that are clearly those of foreigners, Semites. We can tell this by the pottery, by the kind of weapons, the type of tombs, the types of architecture are not Egyptian. The material culture of these people fits with the southern Levant, the southern part of Canaan. Now, this city, I won't go to the next slide yet, was a big city. The Austrians, as I said, have been digging and keeping an eye on this place for quite a long time. Back in the 1960s, they used 850 drill cores. Now, I don't know all the details about this, but they drill down below the surface to whatever depth they think is appropriate, and then they draw up a core sample. And they did this 850 times all over this region to try to get a picture of what was going on underneath. In other words, what things had been like before in ancient times, so they don't have to dig, or at least so they know where to dig. Particularly, they were trying to find out where the Pelusiac branch of the Nile had been in ancient times. They've succeeded in finding that. Now, over the last decade, they have used ground-penetrating radar. And what they have found, because they've only been able to excavate 3% of this city, it's huge. But what they have found is a huge city complex. They are able to determine about where the city began. The city began with about 12 to 20 homes. The city began with 100 or so people, they say. And what were all those other white dots? Did I mention that last week? I think I did. These are all the other Semite cities in Goshen. There are about 20 or so of them. Avaris is one, but there were a whole bunch. Whoever these people were, they filled the land. But the children of Israel were fruitful and increased, Exodus chapter 1, verse 7, increased abundantly and multiplied and grew exceedingly mighty, and the land was filled with them. Following the death of Amenemhat III, and during the first decades of the new dynasty, the village at Avaris expanded into a large town. One author says, not a believer, this seems to have been partly due to a high birth rate. The children of Israel were fruitful and increased abundantly, says Exodus chapter 1, verse 7. Now, this is Professor Manfred Bitek. He's in his 60s, been down there a lot of his life. He is one of the world's most respected Egyptologists. He does not believe this city belongs to the Israelites, and I'll explain in just a moment why. But listen to what he says about this city. We uncovered the remains of a huge town of 250 hectares, that's 618 acres, about a square mile, with a population of approximately 25 to 30,000 individuals. These were people who have originated from Canaan, Syria, Palestine. Originally, they may have come here as subjects of the Egyptian crown or with the blessing of the Egyptian crown. Obviously, this town enjoyed something like a special status, like a free zone, something like that. We have some evidence of shepherds. We find again and again in this area pits with goats and sheep. So we know shepherds, probably Bedouins, with huge herds roamed around this. Now, why would this... I don't know all that's telling him that it's something like a free zone. But why would that fit the biblical account?
Because Joseph told his brothers to tell Pharaoh that they're sheep.
Yes, and why? Why was it important that Pharaoh know that?
Because he would have them take care of his...
Well, that was part of it.
Yeah,
let's read it. Genesis 43. Genesis chapter 43. We'll start there, and then we'll go to 46, what you're talking about. But in Genesis 43, before Jacob even knows, Joseph's down there. Remember, he sets up this meal with his brothers. Genesis 43, starting in verse 32. Genesis 43:32. So they set him, that is Joseph, a place by himself, and them by themselves, and the Egyptians who ate with him by themselves, because the Egyptians could not eat food with the Hebrews, for that is an abomination to the Egyptians. So Egyptians didn't want to sup with Hebrews. But let's turn over to chapter 46 now, what was just mentioned. Genesis 46:33-34. This is what Joseph told his father and brothers. So it shall be, verse 33, so it shall be when Pharaoh calls you and says, what is your occupation? That you shall say, your servant's occupation has been with livestock from our youth even till now, both we and also our fathers, that you may dwell in the land of Goshen. For every shepherd is an abomination to the Egyptians. Do the Egyptians want to live around a bunch of shepherds? No. Here is a man who doesn't even believe these people are the Israelites. And what does he say? He confirms the biblical account at every turn. Timothy Mahoney was interviewing this man. Timothy Mahoney has been responsible for kind of bringing some of this information more into the limelight. After hearing the first paragraph, he asked Manfred Bietak, could these foreigners be the early Israelites? Manfred Bietak said that second paragraph and followed it up with this. But to connect these with the proto-Israelites, not the Israelites, mind you, proto-Israelites, is a very weak affair. According to my opinion, the settlement of the proto-Israelites in Canaan only happened from the 12th century BC onwards. In other words, I'm willing to concede that there were some people who would one day become the Israelites, and they were in Egypt, but they were here long after this city. Now, I'm not going to bore you with a bunch of stuff about chronology, but his whole argument against these being the Israelites is based on what is called the conventional Egyptian chronology. I mentioned to you last week that the new chronology is challenging the conventional chronology. In other words, it's bumping, it's moving things around, and it's proving itself far more accurate, because not only is the new chronology lining up with historical and archaeological data, but it's lining up with astronomical data, which the chronology that Manfred Bietak is using does not. The record that the Egyptians kept of new moons, if you try to fit that with the chronology that Manfred Bietak is buying into, it doesn't line up any better than flipping a coin. You line it up with the new chronology, 97% accuracy, only missing one new moon, which again, like I said last week, could have been obscured by a cloudy day. So all the evidence is being disregarded based on a false assumption. And that's true in a lot of areas. And David Roll, when asked about it, he's the one pushing this new chronology, when asked about why do these people keep disregarding all this evidence, he says, well, it can't fit the old chronology. And so if you want to hold on to that, what you have to do is you say, okay, well, that's just another coincidence. That's just another coincidence. And that's what's going on here. But I like these quotes, because this is a man who doesn't even believe it. And yet, the evidence pretty much speaks for itself. All right. Here is a reconstruction of what Avaris might have looked like all those years ago. Now, this image is not just pulled out of the air. It is based on the exact archaeological proportions provided by the dig site data. It took long, long, long time to create this. Had we been able to fly over Avaris all those years ago, this is what we might have seen. Now, what do you notice about this? I mean, here's the Pelusiac branch of the Nile going around this part of the city. But what stands out about this city as you look at it? Okay, we've got a big portion here that's made of these mud bricks. And this is probably mud brick too, but it's all nice and white. What's going on there? Toward the end of the 12th dynasty, which is right where Amenemhat III, the Pharaoh and Joseph came down, right when he's in power, the government chose to build a royal palace and a temple right there next to Avaris, right next to the river. It seemed to be a favored spot for the royal family during hot summer months. So this is interesting. So here you've got all the children of Israel living. That's where the evidence seems to point us. And then you've got the royal palace and precincts here. Avaris means office of the region, seeming to indicate it was the northern headquarters of the government. So this makes sense why Joseph would live in that area. Furthermore, if we get a close-up view, here's the palace. There would be one of their idolatrous temples. And again, here are the Semitic homes. Have you ever wondered? This had never occurred to me. Exodus chapter 12. Would you turn there with me for a minute? And if someone would read for us verses 29 through 31. Exodus chapter 12, verses 29 through 31. This is when the firstborn are struck in Egypt. Someone would like to read it for us real loud. Exodus 12, 29 through 31.
And it came to pass at midnight that the Lord struck all the firstborn in the land of Egypt, from the firstborn of Pharaoh who sat on his throne to the firstborn of the captive who was in the dungeon, and all the firstborn of livestock. So Pharaoh rose in the night, he and all of his servants and all the Egyptians, and there was a great cry in Egypt, for there was not a house where there was not one dead. Then he called for Moses and Aaron by night and said, "Rise, go out from among my people, both you and the children of Israel, and go and serve the Lord as you said. Also take your flocks, your herds, as you have said, and be gone, and bless me also."
The okay. Egyptian, oh. Thank you, Glenn, very much. Pharaoh wakes up in the middle of the night. There's a wail throughout the whole city. Everyone, every family has lost their firstborn. And what does Pharaoh do? He calls for Moses and Aaron. Now, what had the children of Israel done just that evening? They had killed the Passover at twilight on the 14th. Sundown came, the 15th began. So it's midnight of the 15th. When Pharaoh calls for Moses and Aaron. Moses and Aaron are able to receive word, get to the palace, have Pharaoh tell them, get out of here. And later on we are told that when did the children of Israel leave Egypt? They left that very day. They left the 15th. What relevance does this have to this? They had to get there quick. Where were Moses and Aaron? They were right next door. Because that's where the Jews lived. So Pharaoh could send someone there quick, they could come back, the message could get out, and the people could go. How is it, have you ever wondered? I'd never thought about this. How was it that Moses' mom, Jochebed, could just take the baby and put it that close to the where she knew the princess of the kingdom would go and know that that baby would probably get picked up, and then Miriam would be able to sit there and watch, and they would be able to have a conversation, and Miriam would be able to go to get her mother and bring her back. How do you pull that off? Well, when you live right next to the palace, you can pull it off. So it matches. It lines up. Now, are there any comments or questions? I hadn't asked, but any comments or questions?
Not at this point, but are any of these dwellings possible in his
Well, if what I've submitted is right, and it does seem to line up, that palace that we saw first that had the 12 columns on it, yeah, it would have been. I don't know geographically where it is on there. I could look into that to find out, Mark. It's going to be in there somewhere, though.
Within that building itself.
Not within this building. It was its own structure, separate and apart from that. Yes, Glenn. He's bringing the mic.
Couldn't help but see that that's a nice setup there. So They were getting comfortable with that. So God in his providence saw that this was going to happen. So they needed to leave that. And so, you know, you can kind of see when they go out, when they start complaining, is there were probably some pleasant memories of that.
Yeah.
But they forgot all about why it was so wrong for him to be there too. So.
You know, that's interesting, and I don't want to get off on this, and I've intentionally not brought all this up because it's easy to get off on a tangent and all these things, but there's evidence that Joseph didn't just serve. Now, this is not gospel. This is not inspired. But based on the evidence, it looks like Joseph may not have just finished out his term and then everything went back to normal. He had served successfully for the nation. He had been a savior of the nation. It looks like his son, one of Anku's sons, by the Egyptian name of Reseneb, assumed power in his place. And there's evidence that you've got these Semitic viziers ruling in Egypt for quite a long time. That the children of Israel may have had it really good for a period of time while they were there, until the Pharaoh came who did not know Joseph. Now, we've got just a few minutes here. I want to address one question. I'm glad I don't have a lot of time for it, probably, because it's probably not terribly interesting to you, but it's interesting to me. Genesis 47:27 says that when Jacob came down, he and the family were put in Goshen. Genesis 47:6, would someone read that for us? Genesis 47:6. Thank you. So Pharaoh says, put them in Goshen. And what does he say about Goshen? It's the what? It's the best of the land. Okay, so we all know Jacob and the brothers, the family, moved into Goshen. But look at verse 6. Genesis 47, verse 6. Pardon me, verse 11, I'm sorry. And Joseph situated his father and his brothers and gave them a possession in the land of Egypt, in the best of the land. Well, that's Goshen, right? In the best of the land, in the land of what? Ramses, as Pharaoh had commanded. Now, that's a very Egyptian name, so that certainly makes sense. So what's going on here? The land of Goshen, the land of Ramses? Well, Exodus chapter 1, verse 11, while the children of Israel were in Egypt and were busy building for the government, verse 11 says, therefore they set taskmasters over them to afflict them with their burdens, and they built for Pharaoh supply cities, Pithom and what? Ramses. So according to the Bible, yes, they were settled in Goshen, but in being settled in Goshen, they were also being settled in the land of Ramses, and they built a city called Ramses. And some will say, now, wait a minute. You've got a problem here, John. You're saying that the children of Israel were in Egypt, 1600s, 1500s, 1400s. Ramses didn't roll along till 500 years later. And Ramses II says, he built the city of Ramses. So your Bible doesn't line up with history. Your Bible's wrong. Well, what do we do with that? I remember this being discussed when I was in college. What do we do with that? Well, first of all, we realize that they're making an assumption. They are making an assumption that when Ramses II says he built Ramses, that he's telling the truth. we know good and well that later pharaohs will take credit for what's done by previous pharaohs. Secondly, they are assuming that the land of Ramses is named after Ramses II or someone in that dynasty. How do we know the name of the land and that didn't come before the king of the same name? Those are assumptions. But let's say their assumptions are right. Let's say that, yes, Ramses II is the one who oversaw the construction of the city of Ramses, and that land was not known by that name until his reign, which comes long after the children of Israel are in Egypt. What do we do? Well, there's a second thing we need to remember, and that is that historical sources, including the Bible, sometimes use what are called anachronisms. Hang with me for just a couple minutes, if you will, and I'd like to explain. Does anybody know what an anachronism is? I know some of us do. What is an anachronism? I'll write the word up here.
Is that where you use the current name of an area to refer to New York City? Has not always been New York City.
Right, right. Yes. It's when you take something, it's used in various ways, but most frequently it's when you take something from a future date and you insert it into a record of the past. Now, sometimes when we find that done, it's proof to us that the history can't be trusted. The Book of Mormon, for example, says that 6th century BC Jews had a sword of steel. That's a problem. They make claims that long before Jesus came along, that they knew all about Jesus Christ and all about the church. That doesn't add up with the history that we know we can trust. But sometimes it's just exactly what Jeremy said. New York was founded by the Dutch in 1625. True or false? Well, it was known in New Amsterdam when they founded it. That's right. 40 years later, when they ceded it to the British, it became New York. Can I say that they founded New York? I can. In fact, this is not done infrequently. For example, if you go to a website, you don't have to go searching for it, but New York is named after York, York in Britain. And if you go to a website called the History of York, it says the Roman army in York, and it says the following: over a period of about 300 years, York was home to thousands of Roman soldiers. The 9th Legion stayed in York for around 150 years. Hadrian's Wall was begun, and a new legion, the 6th, based in York, played a large part in construction. Now, here's a historian saying the Roman legions lived in York for 300 years. The Romans didn't call it York. They called it Emboricum. It wouldn't become York till the 800s AD. So were they in York? They were in York. But it wasn't known as York at the time. The Bible uses anachronism. In Genesis chapters 12 and 13, it says Abraham lived in the area of Bethel. Who named it Bethel? Jacob. Jacob, on his way to Haran when he had the dream, he named it Bethel. He names it Bethel in Genesis 28, and Genesis 28 tells us it had been known as Luz. He named it Bethel, and yet all those years before, the Bible's saying Abraham's in Bethel. What's going on there? Well, we're calling a place by the name it would be known as later, and by the name the readers would know it as. So, I do believe that's what we may well be seeing here in the Old Testament here in Exodus, and we'll need to take the rest of that up briefly at the beginning of next week. Ramesside texts in the era of the Ramses say that Avaris was the southern quarter of the city of Ramses. These cities occupied the same vicinity. We're seeing the Bible refer to it as what it was known by at the time, but later. But it was not known as that when they were there. But I'll explain a little bit more about that next week. That's kind of an anticlimactic way to end. Thank you very much for your attention.